aliens and flying saucers.
This is all an illusion. Please pardon the confusion. You made an ass out of yourself and me for a fool.
Hey, hey, good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the 7th episode of Two Writers Sling and Yang. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm a former Sports Illustrated senior writer, former ESPN columnist, author of multiple New York Times bestsellers and a couple of non-bestsellers, and a Bleacher Report contributor. The music you're listening to is Croissant's Master by the excellent MC White Owl. And this podcast is an ode to writing in all its forms, from journalism to songwriting to screenwriting to novel to whatever. And today's guest is way outside the box of the first 6 episodes. If you don't know the name Mike Tolan, you 100% know his work. Among other things, he was the producer of Varsity Blues, I Don't Want Your Life. He was also the producer of Summer Catch, where we saw a questionable Freddie Prinze Jr. trying to throw a baseball, of Radio, of Coach Carter. He's the executive producer of The Bronx is Burning, of Small Potatoes, my favorite 30 for 30 about the USFL. He has some weird, awesome stuff on his resume, all over the place. 1982, wrote The Baseball Bunch. He did a documentary, Hank Aaron, Chasing the Dream. He was a producer of Good Burger. And now, he brings us Morningside 5, which just premiered earlier this month, but will air later in the summer as a 30 for 30 on ESPN. It's a story of the Morningside High School basketball team from Inglewood, and comes 25 years after he followed them around. Anyway, I've known Mike for a long time. He shares my love of the USFL. And now here he is on Two Writers, Sling and Yang.
Mike, you have the I don't know how well you remember this, but the first time I spoke with you was, and this is a good segue here, I'd written a book called The Bad Guys Won about the 1986 Mets. And
sure.
There was a guy who was a quote unquote screenwriter. And
who will remain nameless because I can't remember his name.
I can't either. I don't think he's in the business. It'd be very unlikely. And he says to me, I want to pitch your book to this guy, Mike, and he's done a bunch of movies and blah, blah, blah. And I want you on the line. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was sitting in a coffee shop in New York City, Sunburst, and I'm on the line. And he says, you're on the line. You're like, all right, shoot. And he goes, all right. It starts in a 14-year-old boy named Jeff's bedroom. And he's watching the Mets on TV. And I was like, fuck, what is going on here? And I was thinking, like, there has to be, I mean, your resume is insane. It's deep. It's long. You've done everything. You've seen everything. It seems like there is a good way for a writer to pitch and a bad way for a writer to pitch. And that just struck me as the worst way for a writer to pitch anything
well,
ever.
You remember, he did his pitch. We were as polite as possible. We dismissed him. You called me back or I called you back. And you probably remember what I said.
Yeah.
Worst pitch ever, WPE.
I apologize to you. I actually called you, and I was like, Mike, I just want you to know I have nothing to do with that guy.
I knew that already, and we turned it into something, which, of course, like most things in my business, ultimately turned into nothing. I don't know if we really said this so the listeners know what we're talking about. This was a really entertaining book you wrote about the 86 Mets, one of the wildest, craziest, triumphant seasons in pro sports, at least in our memories. And this guy pitched a ridiculous take on it that was, I mean, it was mind boggling. It was, you know, it was sort of a comedy sketch.
Right.
But after, you know, we digested it and made fun of it and moved on, I said to you, forget that insanity. Let's make the doc. I mean, these guys are all, you know, as a filmmaker who spends a lot of time in the, you know, what used to be called the sandbox. Now sports is a little bit more legit. It's a little bit more part of the mainstream pop culture landscape. But, you know, it's fun and games. But as somebody who's done a bunch of feature films in that world, a bunch of documentaries, a bunch of short form, scripted TV series, so forth and so on, you get a story or you find a character or something whets your appetite and it feels like there's a story to be told. And the first thing you got to do is figure out, you know, why and then how. And, you know, the how is often scripted or unscripted. Now it's long form, short form, digital, linear, branded, not, you know, on and on and on. But it immediately struck me that this makes more sense to pursue as a documentary because the protagonists are alive and I'm guessing, for the most part, willing. The archival material exists. Like, it's sort of like, you know, my problem with, let's just take Ali as a movie that was lauded, mm-hmm. that had, you know, one of our greatest contemporary leading man actors, one of our, you know, greatest American filmmakers over the last several decades. But still, like, I'd rather watch Muhammad Ali footage than Will Smith impersonating Muhammad Ali. So, right. like, give me the documentary any day of the week. So we abandoned that silliness and went right to, let's make the doc. And not to belabor a sinking ship, but we got Ron Darling. He was in, and we basically sold it in a room. You, me, and Ron, and the director, right?
Yep.
And but then we needed to get Daryl and Doc, and we went 0-2, and that was the end of that. But would have been a great Doc.
Yeah.
They made the Daryl and Doc. Did you like the Daryl and Doc film?
I didn't see it.
Oh, okay.
Did you like it?
It was okay. I mean, it was hard for me because, you know, I knew what we could have done, which I think would have been much cooler and more fun.
Yeah, I was told what people said. The complaint was that it felt kind of contrived. You had two guys sitting in a diner having this sort of dialogue that wasn't a real dialogue in a way.
Which... Well, that's true, but I get that. You know, you see the pains of the filmmaker's craft. Yeah, you want that. You don't want it to be obvious. You don't want you don't want to feel the hand of the filmmaker. But my bigger misgiving was that it was sad. And what we would have made would have been so fun and so celebratory.
Right.
Like, I get that Daryl and Doc have had hard times, and I can see that on E60, or I can see that on Real Sports, or I can see that on Charles Kuralt or somebody. Is he still alive? I don't know. But, I prefer to make films where, it doesn't have to be all strawberries and cream, but I just think, you know, that was a raucous team with amazingly fun stories, which you captured in your book. Are we selling some books here at least?
I hope so. Yeah.
So on to the next.
Do you what's the difference between you probably see, I mean, in the course of your life, you've probably seen 8 million screenplays, scripts, etc. I'm sure it's a dizzying buffet of boring and annoying, and every now and then you get a gem. What's a gem? Like, how do you, when you see a gem, how do you know it's a gem?
You don't. You hopefully you're going to laugh, you're going to cry, you're going to be moved, you're going to be inspired, you're going to go, wow, I've never heard or seen this before. Some variation of all of that. Often it comes to me having been read by my very small but very hearty and cool staff of development folks who kind of have a clue of what we want to do and the things I might respond to. I'm going to give you an example. This is sort of like a pitch for something that hasn't happened, but we hope to happen. And, you know, maybe there's somebody out there who's going to, you know, write a $5 million check and then it will happen. No, we think it's going to happen, but this is sort of an interesting circuitous route. So Chris Ballard, you know him?
Of course.
Great guy, great writer, guy. Sports Illustrated, wrote a book called One Shot of Forever. I read the article in SI, and I thought it was good, but like not really a movie. It's basically a baseball Hoosiers, small town in the middle of Illinois, like, you know, barely can get 15 guys to fill out a baseball roster, and they're going against, you know, the 5,000 class of 5,000 from the big school upstate, and, you know, they get all the way to the finals. It's cool and it's real, and I met the guys, and I said no, and then people kept saying, "Tolan, you got to read the book. This is great. You're going to love it." I try to be resistant, and I try to let the evidence being overwhelming, so that it's I got to be resistant and reluctant, because there aren't a lot of guys that do what we do, because it's so goddamn hard to do sports movies or to make mainstream media with sports as a predominant theme or even a backdrop or primary character. So we got to just like say no before we even dive in and assume 999 out of 1,000 will have to remain a no. So I go in, you know, with one eye closed, and then I kept stumbling into people who said, "You got to read this book." And I actually had the Clubhouse manager from the Phillies, whose name is Frank Koppenbarger, who got me the tickets to go see the Phillies against the Angels last night, which was Aaron Nola's ace. Jake, give me a minute for Phillies indulgence, will you? So Aaron Nola pitched his eighth straight game of having given up two or less runs. Is that impressive or not really?
Yeah, it's pretty good, especially for the Phillies.
Except they lost because they only scored one and the bullpen gave up five. Anyway, so Frank Koppenbarger is now, you know, elevated to something, and he gets me the ticket. So he's become a lifelong friend. And every time I see him, he goes, "What happened to that book?" Well, hey, Frank, come on. I just made a movie, Chuck, that, you know, I optioned in 2003. So, you know, give me some time, man. It's only been 5 or 6 years. Anyway, Frank hands me the book as I'm leaving Philly to get back on a plane. And I said, all right, I'll read it. I read it. I love it. I woo Chris Ballard. By this point, there's competition for it. He says, all right, you're the guy. You know, we make an option deal. Really didn't quite attract the right cast, or we couldn't quite solve the third act or whatever. It's a good script. We have it back in development. I want to make it someday. I stay in touch with Chris Ballard. We take shots at different cast members to play the coach. And I do believe someday we'll make it. Meanwhile, a writer named Grant Thompson comes in. He's pitching something, and he says, have you read my script, Morning Glory? And I say, no. And he goes, oh, you got it. I'll send it to you. And I go, is that? He goes, yeah. It's a story that Chris Ballard wrote in Sports Illustrated that I read and decided I didn't want to pursue it because I already had a Chris Ballard thing that was stuck in development. And also, this was too sad. And so I'd read the story and I was familiar with it, but I actually didn't know it was made into a script and it was had studio behind it. He says, I'll send it to you. And it goes to my development guys. And again, I'm like, I'm not really interested. And the two or three of them said, I think you got to read this, Mike. I'm like, no. You really got to read this. So again, with reluctance and resistance, I read it on a plane from New York to the Bay Area. And it's amazing. And I'm, you know, sort of hiding my tears in my seat and on JetBlue. Right. And I'm flying to the Bay Area where Chris Ballard lives. And I'm like really moved by this thing, kind of blown away. And I pick up the phone when I land and call Chris Ballard and say, we got to have breakfast tomorrow. And by the end of the day, I've sort of put One Shot of Forever on hold. And I'm now developing what's called Morning Glory. It's the story of, remember Nick Adenhart, the pitcher for the Angels?
Of course.
Okay, so this rookie pitcher goes out and gets his first major league win. And then after the game, is in a car in an intersection and gets blindsided and instantly killed. The true story is of his college catcher is watching the game on TV from across the country, and he's so excited, and he's calling Nick and leaving messages on his voicemail, and like, you know, he's like living through his buddy and his ex-teammate. Wakes up the next morning, Nick's dead, goes back to the small town in Maryland for the funeral. His father is retiring as the baseball coach. His father convinces him become the baseball coach, maybe as part of a grieving cathartic exercise, being a part of, you know, this town that he was, you know, that he grew up in and he's connected to. And then incredibly, he's coaching this team and they're about to head to the playoffs, and his star pitcher, who's also everybody's favorite guy, is about to go to the prom with his not yet girlfriend, who's everybody's favorite girl. And with no alcohol in their system, they run the car into the tree and immediately after the prom are both killed.
Whoa.
And somehow, you know, they go through the grieving process and, oh, we should obviously cancel the playoffs. We can't play. And then the pitcher's best friend convinces the coach, Nick Adenhart's catcher, to continue playing. And they magically go on this run and win the state title on a suicide bunt in a tie game in the bottom of the ninth inning in the finals. And it's like, you can't make that stuff up. So, man, that was a long way around. I'm sure you'll edit this. I hope you can find a shorter version of it.
I actually love that story.
Well, it's just so damn moving and I'm so excited. And we went back to Grant Thompson and we're doing a little rewrite and we're going to go out with this thing and find cast members. And, you know, I hope I get to tell the story again with a movie being made. It's just, you know, sometimes it hits you. It's got to hit you viscerally. It's got to, you know, on some emotional level, you got to say, people are going to really respond to this. Not necessarily sports fans. There's a lot in it for women. There's a lot of romance. There's a lot of comedy. There's these great real life characters, and it just kills you.
Mike, let me ask you a question about this. Because I think about this stuff a lot, actually, when I watch movies. So I am I'm a bad watcher of sports movies because I feel like I know too much about sports. Right. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I do.
When I saw 42, I hated 42 because I hated Jackie Robinson standing at home plate watching the ball fly out of the park. Do you know what I mean? Like, I hate that shit so much. And the one I really disliked was We Are Marshall.
Oh, interesting.
And I'll tell you why. Because he messed with so much of it. It was, you know, just little things and big things and making up characters and blah, blah, blah. And I felt like this is something that really happened. This is a real tragedy. This is not something to goof around with. But maybe I don't get it. And when I want to ask you, like, let's say you actually make this movie and let's say they didn't win at the end. You know, let's say they lost at the end. Can you, as a filmmaker, can you change that?
Well, I'm going to say no. But one of the most successful and beloved sports movies completely violates that code, and that's The Natural, right? I mean, Bernard Malamud writes this, you weren't born, even I wasn't born, but, you know, a great piece of American literature. And Robert Redford makes this movie, and it's brilliantly shot. It's got a great cast. It's kind of epic and sprawling. And they completely reverse the ending, completely. Like, just, you know, so no, I would not do that. Like, in the the first Chris Ballard story, One Shot Forever, they lose in the finals. I love the way they lose. I love that they come home and it's prom night and they're in their baseball uniforms and they go to the prom and they're all celebrated. And it's kind of like, we lost the battle, we won the war, look what we did. There are lines that you have to establish for yourself as a filmmaker and then just vow to not cross. And we all kind of move them a little bit. We all kind of want to mess with them and take poetic license. But like when we have several movies where we've had to address this. And there's three levels. I have this book sitting on my table and it's called Real, R-E-E-L, V, Real, R-E-A-L, How Hollywood Turns Fact Into Fiction. Mm-hmm. So you can say, radio, a true story, radio based on a true story, radio inspired by a true story. Obviously, they go in order of most religious to the truth to least.
Right.
And inspired by a true story liberates you. But still, even though we use that as the subtitle, here's what I did do, would do, didn't do, wouldn't do. I did compress time. I did composite characters. I did, you know, maybe change the outcomes of some kind of meaningless games during the regular season. I did invent some bit part characters. What I wouldn't do and didn't do is change the spirit of this character, you know, add additional disabilities or make him have special powers, you know, make him Rain Man.
Right.
Right.
He can levitate.
Or like, as one executive said, does he have to be black? Yeah, he fucking has to be black.
Right.
This is James Robert Kennedy. He's black. I got a picture of him in my office. Me and him hugging. Cuba Gooding, great casting, great guy. Had a lot of fun with him. There was a real Coach Jones. He did have that relationship with him. Radio was beloved in this school. Those were his disabilities. He was considered a distraction. They did ultimately lead to the coach being dismissed because they weren't winning and they blamed it on Radio. They didn't win any championships that, you know, that didn't happen in real life. It's the spirit of it. It's the tenor, the tone of it that you have to be true to. You know, in Morning Glory, we'll probably change the relationship between the father and son and how the son chose to come back to the town and coach the team. But the girlfriend is real. And the story of the two kids who died so tragically is completely real. The outcome of the state tournament is 100% real. You know, along the way, you know, you'll do some things, hopefully, that even the people who were part of it won't remember. But it's funny. You have We Are Marshall. I have Remember the Titans.
Oh, yeah. I'm with you. 100%.
Same thing. Like, and yet, here's what I learned. You know, we're making Varsity Blues, which was fictional. So it wasn't so much about, like, you know, adhering to the truth. Although we did go, Brian Robbins and I went to the Texas High School Football Championships in the Astrodome. We watched the games. We met the coaches. We were with the players as they were crying either because they've just played their last game of football or crying because they're never going to see these guys again as they go on to play in college, whatever. Really worked hard with the writer, John Gatens, to make as crazy and out there and as invented as the whipped cream bikini was.
Right.
We feel like we captured the real spirit of Texas high school football. And we worked really hard with the coordinator, Mark Ellis, to make the football fun as hell to watch and authentic and real. And then I see Remember the Titans, like the football is ridiculous. It's boring. It's fake. It's not anything close to real or exciting. The details of the story are completely made up. And it doesn't matter, Jeff. Like, they got Denzel Washington.
Is that what it is?
Well, it's a big part of it. I mean, you know, Denzel Washington versus who?
James Vanderbeek.
Well, no, we had John Voight.
Yeah, right.
So John Voight did just fine. But the dude who, with all due respect, Glory Road, which was the Texas Western, Kentucky. You know what I mean?
Yeah, of course.
Good actor, but not a movie star.
Yeah.
And it just never, you know, kind of cut through. So it's just, you know, you never really, it's the movie gods, are they smiling on you or not?
Wait, would you say, I'm actually being sincere when I ask this. Would you say Varsity Blues is a better movie than Remember the Titans?
No.
Oh.
I would say it's a more fun movie and it's probably more beloved 20 years later. I mean, we are now giving you all these scoops, Jeff. We are now developing Varsity Blues, the series.
Oh, nice.
With Vanderbeek and some others from the crew and from the team, from the cast. I just, you know, feel like, you know, you get a sense when you're out there of which things resonate, which things, you know, have a life that goes way beyond, you know, the video store. I think Varsity Blues has a cult following. I hear people all the time reciting lines of dialogue from it. And also, and I think Remember the Titans really worked at the time. It did probably double the box office, but I don't think it sort of has the legs.
Right.
I don't want to say, yeah.
Better. I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Yeah. You mentioned this earlier, and I'll go with it. So I've had four of my books optioned at one point or another, and I've kind of learned, you know, the first time it happens, you're like, yes. And then by the fourth time, you're like, all right, is there some money I'm getting for free here? Because that would be great.
Right.
And I feel like the book I wrote that has the most sort of narrative sort of feel to it is Walter Payton. And I've been told many times, if Walter Payton were white, my chances would be better. And I wonder, is that true?
I don't know.
I don't mean specifically to him. I mean in the business in general.
Being really pragmatic about it, if it's true, the extent to which it's true is really the extent to which it might be easier to cast because there might be a broader pool of actors who can, quote, open a movie.
Right.
Here's my thing. Okay, now we're going to get into, like, some therapy between you and me.
Great.
I don't know if I want to do this publicly, but, like, I think I might have said this to you. You and I do the opposite thing in terms of the stories we choose and the way we choose to tell them. I like heroes. I like happy endings. And you like scandal and ruffling feathers and creating controversy. And it's funny because I think you might have sent me that book or somebody might have sent me that book. And it just turns out I have a friend whose son, I think, married Walter Payton's daughter.
Wow. Weird.
And I'm like, I can't even get near this thing. It's so toxic. And like, you know what? You understand this. This isn't a knock on you. But like, I don't want to know that shit about Walter Payton. I really don't. I'm fine with Walter Payton being who he was on the field, who he was off the field, celebrated in both. It's not like I want to, you know, hide from the truth. The Phillies are honoring Pete Rose next weekend, putting him on the Wall of Fame. And, you know, this week we're dealing with these allegations that he raped this woman girl who's right. like under 50, statutory rape,
right
from 40 years ago. It's probably true. You know, it definitely impacts my feeling about him. But he is that, you know, he's a different sort of guy. I look at a guy like Allen Iverson, again, just because I see sports through the prism of Philly, mostly Philly misery. But, like, I remember my son was wearing an Allen Iverson jersey for, I don't know, say, fifth birthday. And my mother said, how can you let your son parade around in that uniform of that thug? And I stopped and thought, huh, well, that's what, I get it. That's what she thinks. There's obviously enough stuff in the news with guns and domestic violence and so on and so on. But, like, God, he's fun to watch. And, man, that 2001 season when the Sixers had no shot and no reason to be there and won, beat the Bucks for the conference title and stole a game from the Lakers, and he stepped over Tyronn Lue. And, like, I love this guy. I taught my kids to appreciate NBA basketball by watching this guy. Watch the little guy. Watch, he's going to go score over those big guys. They're going to knock him down. He's going to get up and score again. Like, the competitiveness, the ferocity, that spirit. Like, I love Allen Iverson. I will always love Allen Iverson. And I have no qualms about having my kids look up to him and worship him. You can separate church and state. It's just, I guess, maybe I'm being contradictory here, but I guess when it, you know, and I executive produced the Allen Iverson documentary. I think it was relatively hard-hitting. I think it was truthful. I think it was inclusive of most of the sins he's accused of and some of which he committed. So, you know, okay. But I guess when it comes to adapting for fiction and telling stories, if I look around at what we've done, the stories we've told, you know, it's just a very different quality. I guess maybe it's, you know, now this is good therapy for me. Now I think about the bad guys won. It's like why I gravitated to a documentary. Because if it's real and you can incorporate, you know, all the sins, but all the fun, and just try to, you know, come up with an entertaining stew that works.
You know, what's interesting is I know I actually don't, it's kind of funny. I actually don't love, Scandal. I'm not even just saying that. Like, I hate finding out, let's just say, out of wedlock kid, right? Like, in the case of Hayden. I absolutely hate that shit. And my wife will verify that. Like, I hate it. I just don't know how you write a definitive biography of someone, like a historic accounting of their life. You know, if you find out someone had an affair, like a one-time affair, all right, whatever, who cares? If you find out a guy had a kid who lived 2 miles away from him, who he didn't take care of, but you're writing how great this guy is. I just don't know how you can do that and call yourself a biographer. You know what I mean?
Fair enough. Well, I don't call myself a biographer. You do. You've done it really well. No, seriously. I'm not saying that dismissively or demeaningly. You've done it. You've done really well. You've made a great career out of it. I had a big public argument in 2006 when I was doing a series for ESPN on Barry Bonds called Bonds on Bonds.
Oh, yeah.
And man, was I taken to task. Man, was I vilified. Talk about guilt by association. I go on when Dan Patrick and Keith Olbermann had a radio show.
Yeah.
And they put me on. They're like, how can you call yourself a journalist? I said, I don't. I haven't since I wrote for the Stanford Daily a lot of years ago.
Right.
I'm a filmmaker. And you know, I went to the Disney company all the way to the top. You know, there's John Skipper at ESPN, there's Bob Iger, the Disney company, and they felt like if you really have Barry Bonds, that's the number one story in sports right now, and we're in. And they spent a lot of money for the access that I was granted and was able to put on the screen week after week. That was a disaster. I mean, talk about
I'm trying to remember what happened. Did it get canceled quick, or what was the deal with it?
Well, the short form is that he sucked. He couldn't hit homers anymore. Yeah. So he started like six away from Babe Ruth and 47 away from Hank Aaron. So like he'll pass Babe Ruth in the first 2 weeks, right? And he might get to Hank Aaron by the end. And this is going to be amazing. We're just going to watch this unfold. Whether he was off the juice or he was too old or the layoff had been too great because he had come back just at the end of the previous season. He couldn't hit homers. He was slow. His bat was slow. He looked old. He looked tired. So there was no real drama. It was just a train wreck. He was The Game of Shadows had come out pretty much at the same time. He was back and forth going to the court to defend himself and just to make appearances and stuff related to the book and other accusations. And so it wasn't great TV. And then he finally broke episode six. It took 6 weeks for him to hit those homers to break Babe Ruth. And he goes on Monday morning, all right, I'm going to make the outline this week. This is Barry. I'm going to make the outline. I'm going to dictate the content. This is my show. And I'm like, oh my God, no, you're not. Well, yes, I am, or we're not doing it. I said, all right, well, why don't you, you know, do your work like I usually do. And you want to send me something, send it to me. Meanwhile, we'd been, you know, raked over the coals. You know, I had the thing with Overman and Patrick. That was the tip of the iceberg, you know, on and on and on. It's funny. I had a conversation with Les Moonves during that time. And he said, why can't people separate? Like, NBC has this show, this homemaking cooking show with Martha Stewart, and their news division covers her trial as she's about to go to jail. Like, nobody blames them for doing the other show. You're doing an entertainment show. You're doing a baseball show. And the other is the other. One's investigative journalism and one's entertainment. Anyway, the media didn't see it that way. We were getting crushed. Sandomir was writing frequently in the New York Times. He loved following it. So finally I called John Skipper and I said, look, I made a contract with you and a commitment to you. And if you want this show to continue, understand that these are the conditions that Barry's set out this week for this show, which I'm not comfortable with. And I would, given the choice, walk away from this thing, but I have an obligation to you. And he said, no, we support you. We don't want to do that. We always said we weren't going to compromise the integrity of the show. It's not Barry's show. It's our show. And ultimately, Sandomir got the scoop. And he called. I told him you should get it from Skipper. And there's a column out there somewhere in this early summer of 06 where basically it says Tolan refused and the show died. And that was it.
Wow.
So I kind of feel good about that. As it turns out,
I like how you basically signed up to do a show with the biggest asshole in the history of sports. It's like,
Barry came to me and said, you know, I love what you did with Hank Aaron. I want you to do that for me. And I'm thinking, there's no way you can do for Barry Bonds what you do for Hank Aaron.
Right.
The guy is, look, I love Henry. He's a, you know, the word iconic, the word hero, those things are, you know,
yeah,
used fast and loose and overused. But man, he's now 83 years old and he has aged as gracefully as possible. He is a philanthropist. He is a humanitarian. He's a sweet, wonderful, charitable man. And I'm like, it's one of the great joys of my life is to have him as a friend and be part of his Chasing the Dream Foundation.
Yeah, we talked a lot about him from our first guest on this podcast was Howard Bryant, who did his biography.
Oh yeah, wow,
and,
yeah.
Which is really a good book. Just 2 nights ago, I watched Morningside 5, which really fascinated me. So it's going to be a 30 for 30 in a couple weeks. Am I off on that?
August 8th, Tuesday night, August 8th on ESPN as part of a doubleheader. Just in a crazy coincidence, they were developing two films that centered around memorable high school basketball teams, and they saw them kind of coming to fruition at the same time. So they are doing their, I guess, first ever documentary double bill, Tuesday night, August 8th. The other one's called Baltimore Boys. Ours is called Morningside 5. I think theirs is first, and we go second.
Do you want to do a documentary about the 1990 Mayo Pack High School boys basketball team, which I quit controversially after 7 days?
Show me the footage, man. Let's evaluate.
You followed this team first in 1992, and now you come back and sort of see where they are 25 years later. And am I wrong in feeling like for you, nostalgia and sort of what happened to these guys and where that is not just sort of a driving force in this film, but just sort of in your approach to sports?
Yeah, I think that's fair and accurate. Look, we did this film not looking 25 years down the road that this will be a great series of docs or a great thing to follow five kids for a quarter of a century. I moved to LA, got married, moved to LA, had a kid, in 92 at the same time that this film was originally shot. I was a new father, starting a new life, new career. Brian Robbins was my new partner. We sold this thing to Fox in their fledgling Fox network with a very small alternative TV department run by Joe Davola, who would soon become our head of television at Tolan Robbins for better part of a decade. He gave us the princely sum of 2,500, not thousand, 25, that's 2,500, $2,500 to make a sizzle reel. And said, don't fuck it up. That's Joe. If you know Joe Davola, three words, $2,500 in which to prove that these kids were worth following. And there was a story worth telling. So they had won the state, California State High School Basketball Championship in 92, spring of 92. The five best players were all juniors, so they're all coming back. They're all going to be the next Michael Jordan. They're all going to get four full rides to D1 schools. They're obviously going to waltz their way to a second straight state title. And it's a school called Morningside in Inglewood, California, which is adjacent to South Central. It's right after the riots, right after the Rodney King verdict. These are very charged times, a lot of racial tension. A school that used to be all white became all black, and by this point was kind of majority black, but increasingly Latino. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, I used to hear, like, how are we supposed to get along? We don't listen to the same music. We don't even have the same rules for dominoes. So we can't even play dominoes in the courtyard during lunch. So, like, how are we supposed to relate? The basketball team was all African-American. We convinced administration, faculty, parents, kids to let us essentially matriculate for that year at Morningside. Brian and I bought these little cameras, self-financed it, went to school every day, were there when there were shootings on campuses, were there for the practices when kids got suspended or got in trouble, followed all the games. As you'd suspect, it didn't go exactly according to the blueprint. Kind of went off the rails, kind of amazing stuff you could never script happened. And Hoop Dreams hadn't happened yet, but ultimately there was a collision course and it did happen. And it kind of blew us away. I actually referenced it in the beginning of the film because they had a 5-year arc. And that was really impressive to see the development and the path that these kids took and how their dreams evolved. And I don't remember the chronology, but Michael Apted, a British filmmaker who ultimately became the head of the Directors Guild and also a renowned feature film maker, was doing a documentary series that started with a bunch of 7-year-olds in Britain, started with the thesis, show me the boy at 7 and I'll show you the man. And so he went back every 7 years to visit with these same kids, 7 up, 14 up, 21 up, 28 up. 28 up was about this time, I seem to remember, got a lot of acclaim. And in my head, I think I'm thinking, this might be, you know, a really interesting foundation for a series of docs. You know, who knows, maybe this will become my 28 up. Then again, maybe I'm just making that up. Right. I mean, that's 2020 hindsight. I think I thought that, but I can't swear to it. But I do know that I stayed in touch with these guys. And then when it approached the 10-year mark, I rounded them up again. They were willing. We shot with them. You know, we had shot a little bit from their college. We acquired footage from their college careers. We found them wherever they were. We did the 10 years later. We sold it to Spike, which was a new network. We went through the film festival circuit. And then all of a sudden, it approached 20 years later, by which point there was this thing called 30 for 30. I was, you know, one of the producers in the early days and friends with the guys who were making the programming decisions, and they agreed to take a shot. So I kind of dug in starting in 2013, and, you know, took a while, partly because, you know, I'm juggling a million other things, but partly because I really was trying to see things unfold. And before you know it, as you said, it's 25 years. We go from 92 to 2017. A lot of surprises, a lot of bumps along the way, but a very, very personal journey for me when I realized that, wow, these guys are now the age that I was when we started. There's a little little snippet of footage in the beginning, much like in Small Potatoes, in my better hair days, in the 90s, right?
Yeah.
You know, it was just, we had our first screening in LA, overflow audience in a theater at the LA Film Festival, and then a Q&A afterwards with Ramona Shelburne moderating, mm-hmm. Four of the five guys, the fifth lives in Minnesota, me and Byron Scott and Paul Pierce, both of whom went to high schools in Inglewood, both of whom are in the film. And it was so moving to hear these kids talk about the struggles and what they've overcome to be here. And even more so to hear Byron and Paul and some of the questions from the audience, just congratulating these guys. You know, did they make it to the NBA? No. But does that mean they were failures? Hardly. I mean, that's the beauty of this thing. There's this whole body of sports documentaries that I would put under the rubric of cautionary tales, right?
Right.
Lenny Cook being a great example. Shea Cotton.
Right.
And this is not that. This is real life. You know, Jim Brown's in the film and he talks about, you know, fatherhood and these kids, most of whom had absentee fathers. They're all really engaged with their kids.
Right.
Breaking that cycle. You know, three of the five have college degrees, two of the five have advanced degrees, marriages, jobs, kids. It's real life, and it's really gratifying.
Well, isn't it easy in your profession to be a sucker for the whole, like, you put on some looming music, you show a kid at 18, you know, dunking over some kid, whatever, in a game, and now he's digging ditches, and you put on the music.
Course.
But maybe the guy's happy digging ditches. You know, that's
You
know what I mean? I find that sometimes bothersome. Like, maybe the guy's happy in his life. Just because he didn't end up playing in the NBA does not mean he's a failure of existence.
Well, as I said, my first child was born in that year, and everything for me was through the lens of fatherhood.
Right.
Partly because that became the most important thing in my life, and still is, and will always be. Also because these kids kind of didn't have what I had and what I hoped to be, and which they now are. I have another kid who's adopted, who's 18 now, son. It's completely opposite from my daughter, right? So to your point, like, we're reinventing the paradigm of success. That's a lot of big words. What I really mean to say is, like, we're just playing with a different scorecard with this guy. His aspirations are very different. He's not academic. He's not going to go to an Ivy League school like my daughter. He may not even go to college. I frankly don't think he should.
Right.
But he's happy. And he's got passions, and he's got friends, and he's in the world. And, like, he teaches me every day what really matters. And what you know, he's inventing his own dreams. And, like, it's not for me to say, you need to do this, this, or that. It's to listen and help him, guide him, nurture him, find his sweet spot.
Right. Very well said. Let me ask you a final question here. How can you explain, or let me phrase it this way, more likely scenario, James Vanderbeek, NFL quarterback, or Freddie Prinze Jr. starting major league pitcher?
I have to choose one?
Yeah. Which is more likely? More likely scenario.
The Beak, no doubt.
Was he athletic?
You asked me a question. I answered it. So, come on. You're asking me a very different question now.
Can I build my team around the Beak? That's how I'll end with that.
James threw many of those passes himself. And you want to hear a real quick pitch from the series?
Please.
All right. So the Beak goes to Brown, as we saw in the film. Mm-hmm. He's a all Ivy League quarterback. Because, you know, we can believe that he, you know, could aspire to those lofty heights.
Sure.
Gets drafted by an NFL team, seventh round, kind of like my guy Hogan from Stanford, who did have a few snaps with the Browns last year, but not sure if that's the end of it. Great guy to have on the roster. Knows he's not starting quarterback caliber. Happy carrying the clipboard. Great guy to play, you know, the other team's quarterback in practice. Knows the playbook, fundamentals, good leadership, good personal skills, so forth and so on. So he has his 15-year career, and he's the holder, right? So that's when he gets on the field, primarily is to hold for field goals and extra points. Sure enough, it's could be Philly, some team that's never won a Super Bowl. The clock's winding down. He comes out. The snap comes. If they kick this field goal, they win. He botches the snap. It's this Tony Romo moment. He ends with a face plant, and that's the end of his career. And then we go back to West Canaan and see what happens next.
Wow.
So, yeah, you like that?
I do, actually. I thought you were almost telling me the Ryan Fitzpatrick story until Dartmouth, Ivy League kid.
Spoken like a Jets fan.
Yeah, no kidding.
Oh, man. I think finally the East Coast Green pro football teams. I think my squad is in a better spot than yours.
By far.
Also, two of our basketball teams, right? Like, I'm thrilled to be a Sixers fan right now. I'm psyched for the season.
Yeah.
And you, as a Knicks fan?
I'm actually a Nets fan. I grew up rooting for the Nets, so it's not even.
That's much better.
Yeah. yeah.
You didn't pay $71 million for Hardaway.
Yeah, I know.
But you did. Who did you just pick up?
We got Russell. We got Russell from LA. That's all right. That was a good trade, actually.
That's a nightmare.
What can I tell you?
I want to thank today's guest, Mike Tolan, for joining me on Two Riders Sling and Yang. One can listen to Two Riders Sling and Yang on both iTunes and on bumpers.fm. Reviews are always appreciated. And if you have any suggestions for future guests, I'm all ears. And I'm not just saying that. I really am all ears in this one. You can hit me up on Twitter at Jeff Perlman. You can email me angold22@gmail.com. I'd like to thank the fantastic MC White Owl for the beats. And thank you again for joining me. And please remember, keep riding.
The podcast you just heard was made using Anchor. Ever thought about making your own podcast? Anchor makes it really easy for anyone to get started. It's a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing podcasts. Best of all, it's 100% free. Sign up now at anchor.fm/new. That's anchor.fm/new to get started.